Okay, just for tonight's talk, I'm going to be mentioning a couple of aspects of the Buddhist path, called the Eightfold Path, especially just a couple of factors, how they play with each other to create a more peaceful, wise, caring, still existence, the two factors of the correct or the proper intentions, and a skillful speech. And for those of you who know classic Buddhism, there is the path of practice of Buddhism is called the Eightfold Path, and those are number two and number three of that path. And again, one of the reasons which I mention these two factors is because the first factor of the intention is just a basic kindness and gentleness, the compassion which Buddhists are usually generally known for. And to allow that to come out into one's speech is a very effective way for living in this world. And to allow that speech to, in return, to cultivate nice ways of thinking. So these two, the intentions and the speech coming together and supporting each other on a path of peace, compassion and gentleness. And the reason why I chose this subject was because just coming back from a trip to Sri Lanka, giving many, many talks there, and seeing some of the ways that people talk to each other, especially a couple of my supporters, husbands and wives, you can usually tell by how long a person is married, by how much they bicker together. There's this old story, this old joke, in the first year of marriage, so the husband listens to the wife, in the second year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the third year of marriage, the neighbours listen to both of them. In other words, they argue so loudly. But it's not just that, it's such a shame that you listen to the way people speak to each other. And it's such a harmful way that we interact socially. And it's not just in marriage, sometimes it's with friends, picking faults with each other, sometimes it's in the office, in the workplace. And sometimes that speech which we use can cause such a lot of misery in our lives. Really, we don't know how to cultivate friendship with others. When we don't cultivate friendship and these beautiful relationships with other beings, then we can't really cultivate a positive relationship with ourselves. And when we don't have a positive relationship with ourselves, we end up getting very stressed out, lack of self-esteem, depression and everything else. So we look at the intention behind our speech. And this right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, is one of the most profound of all those eight factors. Because it said one should cultivate thoughts and intentions of letting go, especially letting go of one's sense of self, of one's ego. And not worrying about what other people think of you, not needing to be the best, or not even need to be anybody, just to let go of that sense of self and that ego, that pride. Now, we often focus on the deeper teachings of non-self in Buddhism, but at least this is a teaching which everyone can appreciate and understand. So the bigger the ego, the bigger the problem which you'll have in your life. And the more arrogant, the more proud you are, just the harder it is to make good friends. And the more sort of selfless you are, I'm not talking about a fake humility where you sort of put it on that you're worse than other people, because that just makes you even more depressed. I'm talking of just the being yourself and not measuring yourself against others. And letting go of this idea of a self which measures itself by possessions and by other people's opinions of you or of your attainments and spirituality. While in Sri Lanka, I made a lot of the terrible perversion of spiritual materialism, because you know in this world that people often measure themselves by the size of their houses or by their bank balance or how the size of their car, and people say, oh, you've made it in life because now you can retire, you're only 50. But what have you made in life? You made a big bank balance, but is that what life is all about? So when you say people have made it, sometimes you question that. I mean, that's that materialism, which many of you understand as not really being producive of real meaning and happiness in life, otherwise you wouldn't be here this evening. But we have a similar problem with spiritual materialism. In other words, you know, people to see how good meditators they are, or how much they know about Dhamma or spirituality or about anything else. And you know, many of the people from Sri Lanka here may appreciate that so many people I found in Sri Lanka were so concerned of whether they were stream winners, watch returners, non-returners or whatever, these stages of enlightenment, and almost like wearing them like badges. It was like another thing to add to their big house in Colombo 7 and to their big car. You know, they've got everything in life. Not only they've got material wealth, but they've got the spiritual wealth. They're enlightened. And such ideas were going completely against, you know, what I understand as being like a Buddhist. So letting go of the sense of self and letting go of the sense of ego. And sort of being free from the demands of having to prove yourself to other people and even to prove yourself to yourself. So that this is part of the intention, the right intention, the movement of the mind, which the Buddha pointed out. That if you follow that type of, like, even spiritual materialism or ordinary materialism, trying to acquire things in life, you're just asking for more problems, more suffering in life. You know, that things come into our life, but we tend not to own them. And we tend to share them with our family, with our friends. We don't measure ourselves by our wealth, either material or spiritual. And that way, when we don't measure ourselves by these things, that sense of pride and, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and keeping up with the person next to you tends to disappear. When it tends to disappear, the struggle to achieve things, either in your spiritual life or in your material life, tends to lessen. And that struggle which we have to get on in life, to achieve, you know how much stress and eventual depression that causes. It causes stress when you really work so hard, extra hours, which are put on you trying to keep up the lifestyle which someone tells you you have to have. I was really surprised many years ago even when I found out that even poor people on Social Security in the UK, they were given a TV and a video recorder because that was considered to be the basics of human existence. I can understand that you need sort of a house to live in. But, you know, having a TV and video recorder as an essentials of existence was seemed to be going a bit too far. Because certainly in our monastery, none of us have any of those things, so we're living way beyond the poverty line. And I'd imagine that if we really wanted to, we could sue the Buddhist society for torturing us and keeping us without the necessities of human existence. Obviously that was going far too far, but you see that sometimes what we take as being essential and normal and have to have, you should question that. And this particular aspect of the Buddhist path is saying, no, you don't know. If these things come, fine. If they don't come, fine. In other words, you can have them, but you don't need them. It's the necessity part of materialism which causes a problem. And it's nice to have them if it comes, but it doesn't matter if you don't have them. And the point is that you can have that beautiful attitude towards the possessions of life. Well, you know, take it or leave it. You know, they're not essential to your happiness. And the reason why they're not central to your happiness is you don't measure your ego by these things. As I've mentioned in many meditation talks, and I gave a short meditation retreat in Sri Lanka, it's a fundamental principle of meditation that when you actually focus on something, you actually focus in on a thing. And what's on the edges of your awareness fade off. And the simile I've often given is watching a TV screen. Because when you watch a TV screen, it doesn't matter what size it is. Or what shape it is. I know that most TV screens are rectangular, but if somebody came along and had to design a TV set which was, say, circular, and that'd be sort of a new thing to have a circular TV set, you find that after a while when you look at the center of it, the edges disappear. You don't see the edges, and that's the reason why when you look at a movie on TV, it looks as if you're right there, because the edges of the screen would remind you that it's just an image on a box. The next time you watch the TV, just notice after a few minutes the edges disappear and you're in the center of that screen somewhere. And it doesn't matter how big that screen is, because when you focus in the middle of that screen, it can be one of these huge plasma screen TVs or just a tiny sort of mobile TV screen. In your mind it looks the same. And I've mentioned that to a few people. I mentioned that on my last retreat which I gave here. And A couple of the retreatants were very, very happy that they said they were just about planning to buy a plasma screen TV for $2,000 or $3,000, and I saved them all that money. I think they gave 50% to my retreat center, which was very good business. Because you actually don't need it. The only time it's impressive, the only time a plasma screen TV is impressive is when it's not turned on. And then you see the whole big thing. Otherwise, it looks exactly the same. You try that out. You know, the mental image, you know, when you're actually watching a movie on a small screen or a big screen, in the mind it appears the same. Because you just focus into the center and that's all that's left there. The size is immaterial, except when it's not turned on. Then it impresses the neighbors, fair enough. But why do we want to impress our neighbors so much? And this idea of like pride and spiritual pride as well. So sometimes you have to combat that, to say the whole point of the path. And this is a saying of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, it's not to get things, not to attain things, but to let things go. Now to cut this attachment between the ego and its possessions or what it owns. To be something who owns nothing. You can actually have things, they come into your life, you can enjoy them, but you don't own them. You don't possess them, you don't control them. You can see the beauty of that, because if you have something which you really possess, it's a delusion, because nature possesses these things. So your car, you don't possess the car, nature possesses it. When it crashes, you don't own it anymore, except you're just a bunch of metal. And one of the disciples, his only possession, or his main possession which he had, was a Harley Davidson motorcycle, which was, I think, worth about $40,000 to $50,000. Those motorbikes can be very, very expensive, and that was all his assets were in his motorbike. He told me once, he parked it in one of these shopping malls, and he went to do some shopping. When he went back, it had gone. Someone had stolen it. And that was all he had in life, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 motorbike. And he said he was very impressed with himself, because he'd been coming here long enough. He said, oh, well, it's not mine anyway, it just comes and goes, these things, I can live without it. You know, even though it's a loss, but, you know, never mind. And he actually let it go, he realized he did not own these things. And he was so proud of himself. And it was only then he realized, he noticed, he was actually on the wrong floor of the car park. And he went down, there was his bike. And so he was a double winner. But the thing was, it was a great test of him. So, you know, he was very, very happy. Number one, that he sort of learned how to let go. Number two, he sold his motorbike. But there's a little test for you, because, you know, when we don't own anything, we don't define ourselves by our possessions. So it's much easier to be free that way. So please, whenever you come into this path of Buddhism, please don't get into any spiritual materialism and just define yourself by how much Buddhism you know, how many meditation retreats you've been to, or just argue with other people about your understanding of Dhamma, you know, the Buddhist teachings, and who knows the most, and who's been in the Buddhist society longest, and who's the cleverest meditator, and who's the most enlightened, and who can sit for meditation for the longest period of time. Sometimes people get into that, you know, on these retreats. They see if they can beat their record of sitting down still, half an hour. Yeah, I did that years ago, 45 minutes I'm up to now. That's nothing, an hour. I can sit for 2 hours. That's nothing, I can do 5 hours. As if you're going to get into the Guinness Book of Records. But I remember my teacher used to say, if it really depended on how long you sat still for, if that was really a measure of enlightenment, then all the chickens in the world will be enlightened now, because they sit still for hours on their eggs without moving at all. So it's just cutting away this attachment to the sense of self and measuring yourself by achievements, if not in the physical world, in the spiritual world. And spiritual pride is one of the worst things I've seen. It's even worse than material pride. I mean, people go along and say how holy they are, and how enlightened they are, or how wise they are. It's a sign of actually no wisdom at all, of no holiness at all. It's when one disappears that one gets holy. Because what does a hole mean anyway? A hole is like nothing in it. That's why it's called a hole. That's why it's called a holy life. No one's in there. It's a hole inside. So when one understands that, understands that this first part of letting go is letting go of the sense of self and ownership. So one can literally be free. It's even when I do go travelling, and I travel very, very light. I usually just have my bowl and my little bag, you know, the bag I've got here, it's behind me somewhere. And so often that I've gone through that airport in Perth, and even this last time, people ask me once again, where are your bags? I say, this is my bags, my bag and my bowl. And they said, no, where's your suitcases? I said, I've got no suitcases. Even though you go away for 2 weeks, that's all you carry. And then they say, oh yeah, because you're a Buddhist monk. That's very good. Well done. That's what a Buddhist monk should do. And it's so much easier, because wherever you go, you have very little to carry. And you don't have to wait for these carousels, you know, with all the other people waiting for their bags to come around. And you can just go through the customs and immigration very easily. So that's a wonderful thing to have, like the few possessions. But why is it that we measure ourselves by how many possessions we have in this world? And because of that, we strive and work so hard. And because we strive and work so hard, we get so tired and have so little time for each other and the better things of life. So be careful about possessions, both spiritual and material. The first aspect of that right intention is just to have few things. In other words, to own, little ownership, so no ego and no pride over the possessions you have, and no sense of ownership either. And that's also the case for ownership of your children as well. But that's another big problem which I was reminded of in Sri Lanka, same as in Australia here. Too many parents own their children for too long. In other words, they get to 21, 22, 23, and they still, the parents won't let them go, because they're concerned about them. They go out into the big bad world, or go to nightclubs or whatever. What will they do? They'll have drugs, they get into bad influences. Ah, you've got to allow the kids to learn, sometimes the hard way. Sometimes allow them to make mistakes, so they can learn by their mistakes, as we all had to do. You know, but sometimes it's not even just 20, sometimes 30, 40, 50, 60. I was talking to one guy today, he's 60, and he still has to call his mother every day, and if he doesn't call his mother, she's very worried about him. 60 years of age! So that really is a bit too possessive. So it'd be great, and it's good for us, and it's also good for our kids to give them that little bit of freedom, and give them that responsibility. I must just really praise my own mother, because when I was only 17, all I had was a guitar and a sleeping bag, and off I went hitchhiking to North Africa. She must have worried herself silly, but she trusted me. And it's with that responsibility of going out and learning how to look after oneself and how to survive that you had that sense of responsibility and toughness, which everyone has to have. Obviously up to a reason, but it's good to be able to give your children that freedom to learn away from home. So don't possess your kids either. And obviously, you know, that sometimes that when your child gets married and they find a partner in life, just how many mothers just, you know, still get controlling of their son or daughter once they're married. This is why we have all these mother-in-law jokes in the world. You know, my favourite mother-in-law joke, you know, comes from this comic, I think it was Les Dawson in UK. He said, my mother-in-law has been coming around for Christmas Day for the last 9 years. Every Christmas Day she's been coming around. This year we decided to make an exception. We let her in the house. You know, why do you laugh at that? It's because it's true. So mothers-in-law have got a really bad reputation. And that's not just in the West. That's in Sri Lanka and Thailand, all over the world, and Singapore especially. So we have to be less possessive of things, which is like the first part of the right intention. Learn how to let things go. Don't own things. And when you don't own things, you're like me, you travel light in the world. You don't carry so many burdens. You know, your financial burdens, your family burdens, and even your spiritual burdens. It's amazing how many people, you know, when they go on meditation retreats, are so worried about what they're going to achieve, what they're going to get. That's not why you meditate for. You meditate, as I said, this is Ajahn Chah's great teaching, you meditate to let go, not to attain things. To see how much you can sort of abandon. And the more you abandon, the more free you feel. And abandon all the fear of the future, what might happen, all the memories of the past, all the ego things which wants to own and catch on to everything. That's what we mean by attachment. You know, it's that owning things and grabbing on to things. We don't own physical things. We own our children. We own our intelligence. We own our abilities. Instead of just allowing them just to come and go and flow. But the second part of the right intention, of course, is the best part. I know, well, I don't know if it's the best part, but it's one of the great parts. It's like the compassion and kindness. We should always have like thoughts of kindness, which is a hard thing to do in a marriage, in an office, anywhere. Because sometimes people irritate us. And when they irritate us, what do? We start planning how we're going to murder them. Fortunately, we don't go that far, but sometimes we think like that. Or hoping terrible things happen to them on the way to work. And sometimes it's amazing what you think of to your partners or to the person who employs you. So we look at those thoughts. The Buddha said, no. Don't ever cultivate bad thoughts. But just cultivate thoughts of loving kindness. Now, the door of my heart is open, no matter who people are. Because, with anger, anger is often coming from just delusion, not understanding the way of the world, not understanding that that's the way husbands are. All husbands are the same. I've done enough counselling in marriages now to know that all husbands are exactly the same. So if you get divorced and get another one, you'll find to your surprise that it's exactly the same. Different on the outside, but same on the inside. Just like a different model car, but the same engine. And you come back and I'll say, I told you so. And the same with the wives, they're exactly the same. Maybe sort of, different colour hair or different size, body, but they're basically the same. So that way that, this is husbands being husbands, wives being wives, like mothers-in-law being mothers-in-law, monks being monks, bosses being bosses. And just like that story I told in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, that just that man, it was in Leech Highway. On a hot day, many years ago, we pulled up, because it's like three lanes going in either direction, pulled up at the red traffic light, and because I was in the passenger seat, my window was open, the right next to me, maybe a foot away, was a driver. His window was open as well. He got caught at the red light, and he was raging at the red traffic lights, saying, "You stupid damn lights. Why did you have to change now? I was late." This is not the first time you've done this. You did it last time. And he was screaming and shouting at the traffic lights. There was a great simile there because, the traffic lights have got no bad intentions, nor good intentions. They run on sort of a computer system according to their nature. And it's just traffic light being traffic lights. And it's the same, why do we get angry at our husband or our wife? They're just husbands being husbands. That's just what they're like. You can sort of shout at the traffic light, it's not going to do anything. And how many times have you shouted at your husband? Has that worked? Of course it hasn't. Or shout at your wife. So when you understand that how anger is just a misunderstanding of the nature of human beings, and trying to sort of we get frustrated when they don't go according to our plan. So instead of actually trying to change the traffic light or change the plan, we actually change our attitude towards these things. To accept our husbands as they are, to accept traffic lights as they are, to accept life as it is. In other words, to be a bit more or less demanding of life and of nature. And that's what loving kindness means. It's like an unconditional acceptance. The door of my heart is open to traffic lights no matter what they do. The door of my heart is open to my husband, no matter who he is or what he does. The door of my heart is open to my wife, my kids, my boss, unconditionally. This is such a beautiful attitude. When we do that to people, then we do it to life, then we do it to things. And it's wonderful to have that beautiful unconditional loving kindness to traffic lights, to traffic jams. So aircraft being late taking off. When we do that, we have this beautiful, peaceful attitude of life. And don't think that that's letting things just slide, getting worse and worse and worse. It actually makes things much better and better and better. You try that in your relationship, in your marriage, or with your kids. You find it doesn't make things worse. It's the anger that makes things worse. It's the controlling makes this work worse. It's the demanding too much which makes things worse. But it's actually the kindness which encourages. When I get round to speech, I'll mention that and a few examples of how like kind speech is by far the best way of encouraging the behaviour which you really want. And the last part of the right intention or skillful intention is actually non-violence. Those are actually the three right intentions of letting go, kindness and gentleness. And too often, even in Buddhist circles, sometimes we forget gentleness, especially when we're in a hurry, when we've got something very, very important to do. Too often we can actually run too fast, charge too fast and too forcefully, thinking that the end justifies the means. But the means is the end. You know, the gentleness of life, the gentleness to your partner, the gentleness to your body especially. Sometimes being too forceful for the body. You know, I try and do some exercise, but a lot of times the exercise is gentle exercise. I'm not quite sure, but I think that many doctors will probably know that if it's too forceful exercise, you end up injuring your knees or injuring your back or injuring something or other. It's just too hard on the body, especially when you're 55. You've got to go gently, look after your old body. Just like, you know, you have a car, you know, it's not a Ferrari, you've got to sort of don't push that pedal down too hard. Things are going to fall off your car, things rattle, and that's what happens when you get in your 50s. Very often many things rattle. And if you go too fast, they fall off. But not only just when you're old, even when you're young, that gentleness seems to be such a beautiful part of Buddhism. I know we used to have the words before being a gentle man. You know, that's what's supposed to be your aim in life, to be a gentleman or a gentlewoman. But nowadays we're far, far more aggressive in just the way we walk, the way we do things, the way we drive. It's such a beautiful thing to see that gentleness there and that courtesy. But it all comes from the thoughts of gentleness, of non-violence, of non-aggression. And that's also one spiritual path as well, because I've seen people on meditation retreats, right, this is it, I'm going to become enlightened. I've only got 9 days, I've got to get it out of the way because I've got many other things to do in life. I'm going to go get her. And of course that degree of aggression, I've seen that so many times in meditation retreats, they just get to a brick wall very quickly, get really frustrated, really tense, and you have to, you know, just, if they don't leave, you have to tell them, slow down, be gentle, go and take a good rest. Because a gentle approach is by far the best. And then this is actually basic to the Buddha's path. This is straight from the word of the Buddha. This is actually your intentions, the way your mind should be moving, in like letting go, non-controlling, non-owning, and, you know, kindness and gentleness. And how that comes out in speech is so important, because too often our speech is just, you know, too controlling, you know, it's too hard and hurtful, and it's not gentle at all, it's very violent sometimes the way we speak to each other. And one of the obvious things, I'm sure you know this, that people are very critical. We always tend to criticize other people about things which, you know, we're probably even more at fault with. You know, in Sri Lanka, the couple which would drive me around. Now, one of them was saying, oh, she's always worried about you and making sure you get there on time. And actually, he was the one who was worried about whether I get there on time or not. We always tend to criticize other people about what's actually inside of us. So I notice even like monks who criticize other monks for being lazy, it's the lazy ones. It seems to be, if that's a fault in you, you're very aware of that failing in life, and you see it in other people as well, which is why you criticize those things. But that sort of critical mind is just very, very hard to bear. Especially when you see the way that most people talk to each other is mostly criticism. Putting each other down, or putting the world down, or putting the soccer team down, or putting the government down, or putting somebody down. It's very, very hard to bear. Now, in my life now as a monk, you know, you do see politicians. Actually, one of the things which I did while I was in Sri Lanka was have breakfast with the president, Mr. Rajapaksa, and it was in his palace. So I went into the president's palace, and I'll let you into a secret. In the president's palace, he serves you baked beans. I always saw that in such sort of high society, you always get good baked beans. And it was very delicious baked beans. So baked beans for breakfast served by the president. So I think somebody sort of tipped him off what I like. But anyhow, sort of, I always feel a lot of compassion for people in such positions of authority, because they're not just in positions of authority, they're also in positions where they're attacked from all sides, you know, by especially the press and by the public. This is so tough, you know, being a leader, simply because every good thing you do, every kind thing you do, every positive thing you do is always taken for granted, and any mistake which you happen to make, that's the one which is remembered and recalled and publicized in the newspapers. And sometimes you read the newspapers is not a very gentle or kind medium. I know it was true that, I mean, somebody was actually suggesting, one of the monks I saw in Sri Lanka, was wanted to start a Buddhist news channel. And he said, no, a good news channel, let's run it as a Buddhist news, you know, on the internet, and make sure it's just the positive things which are happening in society. And I told him that's been tried before. A newspaper once started in the United States, a good news newspaper, they wouldn't put any tragedies or any bad things which happen, except if somebody really cared and helped, like the bushfires down in Dwelling Up. You know, the nice things which people did, that's the sort of stuff they put in the newspapers. But of course, no one bought them. And the company went bankrupt within a few months. And it's, why is it that we like, you know, to hear bad news? Why is it we like to speak badly of other people, criticizing them, putting them down? It's obvious, it's because when we criticize someone else, we're putting them down, and that means our ego gets higher. And a lot of times, all criticism, you know, comes from a sense of, you know, personal superiority. As if we could do better than John Howard. And probably could do, because that's not really a good example, but... but, you know, it's not easy being a politician. So, understand, it's just... Some of those politicians have to have such thick skins because of all the flack they get from the left and the right. And sometimes they do try and make compromises. But you know that old saying, even about the Buddhist middle way. Remember that old saying? He who walks the middle path gets hit by traffic coming in both directions. So, you know, you do get it from both sides when you try and be a mediator. But it's not so much of us receiving that bad comments, but just watching our own mind, and just how much do we use, you know, what in Buddhism we call like unskillful speech. An unskillful speech, the Buddha said, is always harsh speech, critical speech. And he said the opposite of that is speech which actually goes to the heart, you know, which people like to hear, which is encouraging and positive. And that type of speech is not just sucking up to people. It's not just like smarmy weasel words, as they say. It actually is very positive. It works. And you come to the goal which you really wanted to come to in the first place far more efficiently. Because why is it that we get so critical of each other? Because we see faults which need to be mended. Most of speech is like management speech, fixing up faults and errors in another person, or in the government, or in the house, or something. You know, it is coming from fault finding. And that's part of our life. We have to find fault to improve our situation. However, to get to that goal of improvement, you will always find that kind, gentle speech always is far more effective on getting to the place you want to go to. But I first learned this in education, before I became a school teacher, doing some courses in educational psychology, the old positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. In the school, they tried many, many times when a child made a mistake, get punished, tell them off, scold them, giving them a black mark, a big cross next to the problem. And the opposite is you forget all the faults, you don't even say anything when a child makes a mistake in maths or English, but when they make it correct, they do get the answer right, you praise them and say, what a wonderful child you are, how intelligent, how great it is you've seen this. And time and time and time again, in that very clear situation of education in school, They found so many times that when you give that positive reinforcement, the child learns quicker with less emotional problems. They don't lose their self-esteem. They like to learn instead of getting negative to the classroom. And how many teachers know how negative many students are in the classroom? Why is that? Because of too many, much scolding and punishment, less encouragement. And just as that works in the schoolroom, that works in life too. If you encourage people rather than scold them, praise them for those things you want to see in them. In other words, when they do come home early, just show them how much you appreciate that. You know, when your kid does do well, great, wonderful, praise them. But please don't always keep demanding your kid comes, you know, in the top 5%. That's one of the things I said both in Singapore and Sri Lanka on this trip. If your child comes in the top 5% on TEE or at school, or in the bottom 5%, they're not a good Buddhist. If your child comes in the top 5% or bottom 5%, they're not good Buddhists. Buddhists believe in the middle way. You come in the center somewhere, that's a good Buddhist, the middle way. You know, you're supposed to avoid extremes. And it's true, because the kids in the top 5%, sometimes they get so stressed out trying to keep, you know, up there, and the bottom 5% think they're useless. No, both, you know, the top 5% and the bottom 5%, they're all freaks, they're not normal. So when you look at it that way, you understand what the Buddha meant by the middle way, and it takes away all this pressure on achieving. If you get there naturally, fine, but if you have to work so hard and stress yourself out and create so many emotional problems, that's not a good thing to do. But that encouragement of right speech and kind speech and gentle speech, people don't realize how powerful that is. And I gave a talk in my monastery last night down at Serpentine about the power of gentle sort of loving, kind speech. Because what it is get everybody behind you. They want to work with you rather than having this terrible antagonistic speech, which is always putting people down, always trying to control them, scold them through anger, through fear, to see who can shout the loudest or who can actually be the most cutting in their satire, the cynicism. And sometimes, you know, no matter how good your English language is, there's always somebody who, you know, who's more sharp with the way they use the words. You can't beat sort of that Oscar Wilde. His greatest put down I ever heard, when he came out of some sort of nightclub or some bar completely drunk. And of course, and this was a time when being drunk was even worse as a social stigma than it is today. Actually, probably in Australia, it's not a social stigma at all, but an accolade. But anyway, in those days when being drunk was considered to be sort of socially unacceptable, he came out drunk and this woman said to him, "Sir, you're drunk." And he replied, "Madam, you're ugly." And then the killing phrase was, "And the difference between us, in the morning I'll be sober." Now that is a good example of harsh speech. Not the sort of thing a Buddhist would do. But it's incredibly cutting. And if you get into that game, you'll always find somebody who's got a better riposte than you have, and you get cut down to shreds. And that's not a good game to play, to see who's the sharpest, who's got the biggest sort of cut down and negative response. And whenever I've seen that, I said, I'm not playing those sorts of games, because it's just ego trips again. You know, who's the sharpest and who's the best? And it's far, far, far more appropriate in our modern world to use words which, instead of build this terrible antagonism between people and this separation between people, which actually get people on side, which actually create bonds between people, kindness between people and friendliness between people. And you really just have to be very careful the way you speak so you don't antagonize each other. In this world now, it is very easy to be fragmented, and with the availability of all sorts of weapons and bombs and goodness knows what else, we can't afford to antagonize each other. And a lot of times it's just unskillful speech which antagonizes each other, instead of actually praising, praising the moderates praising the kind people, praising the goodness in another person or in another religion or in a politician or whatever. Because whatever you focus on or whatever you praise, whatever you look at and put the spotlight on, but with your speech, that does tend to grow. So it's a policy of mine over many years in being a teacher in a monastery, is actually to be very, very uncritical of the monks I'm supposed to be training, but being very, very praising of when those monks, start to keep their rules well, start to be more restrained, start to meditate well. And I use the way of positive reinforcement to create a harmonious community. And having learned that that works very well in the confines of a Buddhist community, a monastery of men living together without many arguments, you can actually see just how that can work so well just in family life or in the office. Gee, sometimes is what I hear, what happens in office and politics and backstabbing. And that just hurts everybody. It hurts the company, it hurts the people there, it hurts the families when you go home with all that negativity. Why on earth can't we speak kindly to each other? I really mean that, to speak kindly and show each other how much you appreciate them and say thank you. And I really appreciate what you've done and that extra work which you did. Because you do find that people actually work with greater harmony, you get more things done, you get more energy, because it's just motivation. A little bit of kindness in your speech, a little bit of gentleness, gets you far further. So if there is a problem there, don't go shouting at someone, because when people shout at you, what happens? They shout and scream at you, made a mistake and you shouldn't do that again, that's not why we employed you, yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, do you really take that person seriously? Do you really listen, or you just want to get out as soon as you can because you're embarrassed or because you're afraid and it's really unpleasant? You don't really listen to what they're saying. The message hardly gets through. And it's a much more effective, to take the person aside and realize that you're behind them, you want something to improve in the company, but not at their expense. How can we help? Now look, there's a problem here. Speak softly, speak gently, and also take your time. Sometimes it's not just the words we use, but the speed of our speech. Because you notice that when you slow your speech down, and you speak much softer, it has this beautiful result of calming people down. But when you start to raise your words and do speak very loudly and very quickly, because you don't want to speak quickly enough, say people, rah, 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 it really excites people. I remember when we went to the auction for the nuns' monastery land. There we were, with our treasurer at that time. He's here this evening, the old treasurer. And they were having an auction for this land where our nuns' monastery is. And it was amazing actually to see this auction of the way they started and say, oh, this is an amazing piece of land here and we think it's probably worth maybe 1 million. So let's start with 1 million Australian. Anyone for 1 million Australian? And then he sort of started bringing it down. And once we got the first bid, I think it started off about 500,000, 500,000, 500,000, 525,000, 525,000, 525,000, 555,000, 555,000. He started speaking really fast to try and excite people and get them upset. But fortunately, being Buddhist monks, we could outwit him by our calmness and stillness. So it's great having a Buddhist monk at an auction to cool people down. But you can actually see just how the speed of speech actually affects the effect it has on your listeners. So if you want to create more peace and calmness in this world, especially in your marriage, when somebody is shouting at you, you just be very calm. And actually speak softly. If you speak softly and calming, actually you calm the other person down. If any other person's had some sort of tragedy or whatever, you speak softly. I always remember this great example of my predecessor here, Ajahn Chakro, in Thailand. He was a senior monk there. When this lady came in one morning while we were eating our breakfast, our one meal of the day, and it's so unlike a Thai person actually to come in there and just rush into the room and start waving her arms around and screaming something out. She was obviously very, very upset because the Thai person doesn't usually act like that in front of the monks. And we were looking at our senior monk at that time, Ajahn Chakro, to see what he would do. And he just looked at her and then stopped and carried on eating. He completely ignored her. And at the time, I thought, that's really being a bit disrespectful. This woman's in problems. But it was such a beautiful response, because he'd never actually responded or accepted sort of the way she was acting then. She actually calmed down and calmed down. And once she actually calmed down, and then it was a time that Ajahn Chacko stopped eating, and he asked, what's the problem? And then she told her best friend had just shot herself, and she found the corpse. There was obviously a big problem there. But the way it was dealt with was so wonderful. You know, he would not sort of encourage exciting speech with more exciting speech, because then he would just be part of the problem, putting fuel on the fire. He waited for the excited speech to die down, which it would do with inattention. And then afterwards, you know, he started with this very soft and sort of investigation of what's happened, but using a very soft and kind tone of voice. So your voice, the way you speak, has enormous power, which is why the Buddha said, you know, cultivate with mindfulness skillful speech, you know, kind speech, soft speech. You know, don't speak too much, otherwise people won't value it. Don't be sort of, you know, motor mouths, you know, because if you're motor mouth, then people never actually listen to what you're saying, because here they go again, wah, 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 wah. So it's wonderful to be silent a lot, and to speak when it's necessary. As one wise person once said, if you can't improve upon the silence, then don't speak. What a wonderful saying that is. If you can't improve upon the silence, then be quiet. So when we learn these skillful speech, it actually goes back in the way we think. Because when we don't speak angry thoughts or critical thoughts of others, but kind thoughts, when we actually speak gently, we find, to our surprise, that becomes also the way we think as well. We are kind thinkers, and we are gentle thinkers, because these two actually condition each other. The thoughts, which is the inner speech and the outer speech. So the more you actually put restraint on the way you speak to each other, and you deliberately say, I'm going to speak kindly and gently and frugally, you actually do find that you are thinking kindly and frugally, because that inner speech is actually you're talking, but to yourself now. And the way you talk to others is the way you talk to yourself. And if you learn how to restrain your speech to others, so you're kind and gentle, you find you think kindly and gently to yourself. And that is one of the main points of my talk tonight. By learning how to speak to others, you're learning how to have a beautiful attitude towards yourself. In the quiet moments, or when you're supposed to be quiet, in other words, there's no one around you, the way you think, the way you look at yourself, the way you speak to yourself, becomes this beautiful, skillful encouragement, rather than always putting yourself down, always finding fault with yourself, and shouting yourself, and being aggressive and violent to yourself with your thoughts. And of course, that's what the cause of depression, lack of self-esteem, the inner negativity, that stress, and not liking yourself. The accumulation of a lifetime or many years of negative thoughts to yourself, simply because that's the way you've been conditioned to speak. It goes back to you in the end. That's almost like the Buddhist law of karma. What you say to other people, you get back, because that's the way you speak to yourself. So if you're very, very negative to others, and always forcing them, and scolding them, and picking fault with them, that's how you look at yourself. You'll always be scolding yourself, picking fault with yourself, never being kind and forgiving to yourself. And you know what it's like when you're like that. You have no peace, no happiness, no joy, but worse, no encouragement in life. You know, by speaking kindly and gently to others, you're actually encouraging them to the proper goals, you know, success, solving the problems, harmony, whatever else you want to achieve in life. And by having that same inner speech towards yourself, those are the goals you're going to reach. You're going to be more peaceful, more happy, even more successful in your own inner life, in your spiritual life. So as we speak to others, so we think to ourselves. And that becomes so, so important when you meditate, because when you meditate, you have an attitude towards your meditation. And if you've spent your whole life scolding other people, when you start meditating, you scold yourself. I'm not good enough. I can't meditate. I can't get still. You can see how you're scolding yourself, those thoughts you have, you know, in your mind. Or you're too aggressive. You know, come on, you know, wife. Come on, husband. So get your act together. You know, just get somewhere in life. You have that same attitude towards yourself. When you have that kind, gentle speech towards others, then you have that kind, gentle attitude towards yourself. You're encouraging yourself. And just as in I learned in educational psychology, that gets the most out of the students. You love to learn, you get encouragement to be successful, you learn much quicker, you enjoy your time at school, and you want to go to school. In the same way that when you're encouraging yourself that way, when you're kind to yourself, and praise yourself when things go well, forgive yourself when you make mistakes. People love to meditate that way. They just love to be here. Instead of always trying to escape and go somewhere else. All of the, you know, the bad acts of virtue in our world are all from escapism. You know, we get drunk just to escape from the present moment, escape from ourselves. We don't like ourselves. We take drugs. You know, we go into the sensual world of sex with other people. People's wives or husbands or partners or whatever, just escapism, that's all it is. And what are we escaping from is, you know, where we are, what we have. And so it all comes from a lack of kindness, a lack of gentleness, you know, a lack of letting go of our ego instead of like building up to be some big shot or some power guy or power girl. So these two factors, they work together. Of like the thought, the intentions one has, and the speech which comes from those intentions, and the speech reinforces the intentions, the way the mind works. If we could only have more kindness in our speech, because that's something you can actually work on. The thought, sometimes you're not too aware of those things, but at least if we control our speech, more mindful, more careful in the way we speak to each other, not only will we have a greater harmony in our families, in our office, in our monasteries, in our societies. Instead of being so critical of our politicians or our police or whatever. It's amazing reading the newspapers how it seems the whole society is falling down. The education system is shot. The police system is corrupt. The politicians are lazy and incompetent. Now, everything is falling apart. But if you go to, you know, like these third world countries, you realize what falling apart really means. This isn't falling apart. You know, this is a country which is quite successful and it works reasonably well. So, but why do we think like that? We're just so negative in our thoughts and so negative in our speech. No wonder we have so many people depressed and anxious who can't live with other people, who can't live with themselves. Who are just suicidal or on sort of drugs, either prescribed by your doctor or just brought off the streets. We can do a lot better than that, just by having some positive speech and positive compliments and just some gratitude. The gratitude for life, the gratitude for ourselves, the gratitude for our partner in life, the gratitude even for our government. You know, the gratitude just for life. And the gratitude for ourselves. Just politicians, they're just like the old traffic lights. They're just being politicians. They're trying to do their best. It's not an easy job. Just like your husband and wife, not the best, but they're doing their job the best they can. And they're all trying their best. And you're trying your best too. So please, be more accepting of yourself, more kind for yourself. Start with your speech to others, and from your speech to others, see if you can actually develop those beautiful thoughts. The inner speech follows the outer speech. And the inner speech is what gives you the peace of mind, the gentleness of your heart, and the freedom of inside. So that's just how skillful speech leads to skillful thought, leads to happy person. Thank you. Okay, so who's got any comments or questions on the talk this evening? Yeah. Okay, in Soweto, that's a dangerous place. So what happened? So you went to the very poor places of a very dangerous place. Yeah, just saying how those sorts of attitudes of like kindness and letting go and not comparing yourself with others was what kept sort of South Africa from exploding after apartheid was destroyed. And it's so true. Just, you know, what are we aspiring for? When we do aspire for material wealth, it's for the inner happiness and the peace and the prosperity of the heart. And sometimes, you know, we wonder, what are we sacrificing? We're actually sacrificing the very things we want money for, you know, by trying to work so hard to get it. You know, our happiness, our togetherness, our kindness, the joy of just being with friends. That's one of the wonderful things with being with a friend. You don't have to pay for that. You're with a friend, you just spend time together. And no one charges you for being with a friend. You don't charge for being with your wife, your husband, with your kids. Nicest things. We don't charge for coming to the Buddhist center here. Beautiful things in life. So you don't need any money to come be a Buddhist and be here. Isn't that a wonderful thing to be? Okay, so please be kind with your speech. Be gentle. And that way, it's you make a better world. A more harmonious world.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.